enters. Chapter 25. Who specifically would persecute Paul? And what is so sad about this? It was a... Nobody got that one. Rob, are you ready to go?
Sure. I put really Festus T was a principal man of the Jews. And I put it was a favor of their
influence. Okay. Anyone else? Anything else?
I put abuse.
Betrayal.
Sign.
Yeah, I was looking for abuse. Okay. But you may have interpreted that differently. In line with the previous question, what was so sad about bringing charges which could never be proven? It was a...
doesn't go the answer in many ways.
Oh, Greg, you were thinking like I was, so keep going.
I put an indication of the falsehood.
What? That's not what I had in mind.
That's a good answer.
It is a great answer.
A violation of their faith.
So, waste of time, whatever. Right, right. All right, I'm going to skip the third one now. If I forget it later, remind me of it if you remember it. Question four. Describe Festus's view of Paul's case, and what purpose does Festus state for holding this public trial? Gary?
Festus really, he didn't really know what was going on. He didn't find anything worthy of imprisonment either, really. He held this trial to find out what was going on.
Right.
He could know what was going on.
The second part of the question, with these things in mind, what does this seem to imply about Rome's understanding of an official policy with the Christians?
Yeah, they kind of felt that it was kind of a second Judaism.
Right. They're not really sure.
Yeah.
In fact, they don't even know that they're not really sure. These are some known unknowns for them, right? Chapter 26, what made Herod particularly well-suited for hearing this case? John Bosworth, please.
He was familiar with the customs and controversies of the Jews.
Marcy, what did Paul find inconsistent about the Jews pursuing him?
They knew his background and they knew
right. The resurrection of the dead. Why is that such a surprising thing for you? Someone who had made such a great change, what questions should this make people ask? So you got this guy who's running around killing Christians, and then preaching Christianity, what would that make you ask?
What had happened?
What happened to this guy?
Is he telling the truth?
Right.
Things like that, it's like, wow.
Right. Hence his explanation, I saw a light from Jesus. And if he's telling the truth, then, wow, okay, that's a big deal. From whom did Jesus rescue Paul? Who on this side's good to go? John Bosworth, please.
I put Satan.
Okay. Anybody else? Anything else? Jews and Gentiles is what I had written down from verse 17. Rob, this trial before men was actually an opportunity for Paul to do what?
Share testimony and conversion for Christ.
Describe the circumstances surrounding all the events of the gospel. Greg, did you understand what I meant this time?
I'm not sure, but I said Paul said that they were not done in the corner, so it was open for all.
Right, public, very public. The reason I bring that up, I'm not going to drive home a point about this, but some people will say, look, nobody knew about Christianity, and it was untestable, unverifiable. Well, people all around everywhere knew about it. So it's not like this is something hidden, done in a corner, and suddenly, exploded, although it did explode. How did Agrippa respond? And I don't even know how I ended that sentence because I can't read my writing. Gary, what did I say?
How did Agrippa respond? And was time really the preventative to his conversion?
That's what I wrote? Oh, I understand the question perfectly.
I thought you said finish reading the question.
Yeah, I did.
Oh,
I did. So good. What's the answer also?
he says, you almost persuade me to become a Christian. And this time thing, Agrippa, you had plenty of time. That was an excuse, really.
Right.
That was an excuse.
So time was not the issue.
In fact, he understood quickly.
Yes, right.
Right. Right. Yeah. Okay. So, in chapter 21, Paul goes into the temple. He's arrived back in Jerusalem. He goes into the temple. The Jews catch him. They're trying to kill him. That's verse 30, verse 31, they're trying to kill him. The Roman cohort finds out, verse 33, he comes down and gets Paul, and he began asking him who he was and what he had done. Well, Paul gives his testimony to the Jews at the end of that when he says, I'm going to turn to the Gentiles. They stop listening to him. They're crying out. They're trying to kill him. Verse 24, the commander ordered him to be brought into the barracks, stating that he should be examined by scourging so that he might find out the reason why they were shouting against him. So he still doesn't know the answer. He's going to whip him, except for Paul says, I'm a Roman. So verse 30, the next day, wishing to know for certain why he had been accused, he still doesn't know. So he brings Paul before the council. The council, Paul stirs up them, the Sadducees and the Pharisees. Verse 10, there's a great dissension. So the commander was afraid that Paul would be torn to pieces, so he takes him away. But he still doesn't know why Paul's being charged. Then there's a conspiracy against Paul. The commander finds out about it and says, look, I'm going to send you to Felix, the governor. In the letter he writes, verse 30, when I was informed that there would be a plot against them, I sent him to you at once, also instructing his accusers to bring charges against him before you, because I don't have a clue what they are, is what he's still saying. So they deliver him to Felix. Chapter 24, verse 1. After 5 days, the high priest Ananias came down with some elders, an attorney named Tertullus, and they brought charges to the governor against Paul. After Paul had been summoned, Tertullus began to accuse him, saying, since we have, through you, attained much peace, and since by your providence reforms are being carried out for this nation, we acknowledge this in every way and everywhere, most excellent Felix, with all thankfulness. Now, here's a little something from history. Tacitus, a historian, writes about Felix that he is a master of cruelty and lust who exercised the powers of a king in the spirit of a slave. This man is not a nice man. In fact, within 2 years, he's going to be removed from power because he can't do his job, which is evidenced in the fact that when the cohort brought Paul to Caesarea, how many soldiers did he bring? 470. Well, that's not because he's so worried about Paul, although he is worried about Paul. The reason is because the nation's in such political anarchy and chaos that it needs this for a political prisoner. Okay? It's in chaos. And this guy stands up and says, oh, you're just the greatest thing ever. He is a true politician.
He's just buttering him up.
Right. So, Paul goes... Tertullus, the lawyer, keeps going. We have found this man, verse 5, we have found this man a real pest and a fellow who stirs up dissension among the Jews throughout the world and a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes. And he even tried to desecrate the temple. And then we arrested him. Verse 9, the Jews also joined in the attack, asserting that these things were also so. So they're attacking, they're saying, Paul, he's the one that did this. This is what Paul has been doing. Is this the first time Paul has been accused? No. Has anybody ever been accused who was in the right before this? Was anybody who was in the right ever accused before this? Can you think of a few?
Joseph.
Stephen. John the Baptist. I mean, keep going. Before them, the prophets before them. Oh, you can't see anything because I'm not doing it. The prophets before them. It seems that we have a pattern. We have a pattern. What is the pattern?
Jesus said the blood of all the prophets. I mean, he covered a long span.
Right.
It's going to be
from Noah. Right. Abel.
Because you are...
Right.
You are continuing to do the same thing your father did.
Continuing to do the same thing. We have a pattern. What is the pattern? What did the fathers do? What are they doing? The pattern is, if there's somebody who stands in the right, what happens to them?
Persecuted.
Maybe not death, but persecuted. Those in the right are always persecuted. This is the pattern. So, when we go out there and we teach the plan of salvation and somebody says, you're a jerk, should we be surprised? Not at all. Well, what about those who also believe the same thing as we do about the plan of salvation, but believe other things about authority than we do? And we say, well, let's study these scriptures here. and they say, you, and they call you a name, whatever it might be. Should we be surprised? So what is the question? The question isn't if or when we will be persecuted, because if we're doing our job, we will be persecuted. What is the question? Are we right? Assuming that we are correct, assuming, and we could be wrong. But assuming we're correct and we're persecuted, what's the question?
How's our response?
What is our response? What are we going to do? What are we going to do when we're in the heat of the moment? 1 Peter chapter 4. Therefore, verse 1, since Christ has suffered in the flesh, arm yourselves also with the same purpose, because it's going to happen. That's what he says. Almost what he says. I'm paraphrasing. Because he has suffered in the flesh, he who has suffered in the flesh has ceased from sin. See, you're no longer a sinner. Now, this is going to talk about specific behavior, but it applies generally across the board. So as to live the rest of the time in the flesh, no longer for the lusts of men, but for the will of God. For the time already past is sufficient for you to have carried out the desire of the Gentiles, having pursued a course of sensuality, lust, drunkenness, carousing, drinking parties, and abominable idolatries. In all this, they are surprised that you do not run with them into the same excesses of dissipation and they malign you. And I'll stop there. They malign you. Don't be surprised when it's going to happen. So how are we supposed to react? Verse 5, listen, they will give an account to him who is ready to judge the living and the dead. They will. And guess who else will? Every single one of us. And so that's what you, when somebody's out there picking on you, how do you, the question is, how are you going to react? And you always keep in mind the bigger judge, the one with the bigger stick. You notice, we are telling ourselves this continuously. This comes up often in our Thursday and Wednesday classes, the Thursday and Sunday classes, and Wednesday classes too, we have them. But this comes up, I wonder if God is preparing us for something. Something specific. Maybe he is. What's the question? What are we going to do? Exactly. Always do what's right. Okay, we pound this in, and maybe nothing like what we're talking about will ever happen to us. This horrific degree that we're talking about. Maybe it'll never happen to us. But if it does, we've had plenty of time to prepare. So in that moment, when this horrible thing is happening to us and we fail, whose fault is that? Our own. Because we've had so much time to prepare for it. Comments or questions on this? So, back in Acts 24, Paul is accused. Paul then gives his defense. I'm not going to read the whole defense. Other than verse 10, he makes his defense cheerfully. Since you can take note, and he goes on and on for a little while. Verse 20. Let these men themselves tell you what misdeed they found when I stood before the council. Other than this one statement which I shouted while I was standing among them, for the resurrection of the dead, I'm on trial before you today. But Felix, having a more exact knowledge of the way, put them off, saying, when Lysias, the commander, comes down, I will decide your case. And then he gave orders to the centurion for him to be kept in custody, and yet to have some freedom, and not to prevent any of his friends from ministering to him. But some days later, Felix arrived with Drusilla, the wife, his wife, who was a Jewess. This lady, there are very few people. You remember Pompeii, that big mountain that, well, Mount Vesuvius exploded? She died in that. Her and Pliny the Elder are the only two people that I have read, are the only two people of note who have died. So this woman dies in that in 79, I think. Anyway, his wife, who was a Jewess, by the way, she was unlawfully divorced from her husband. Felix convinced her to divorce her husband and marry him. Okay, that'll be important for a second. They sent for Paul and heard him speak about faith in Christ Jesus. As he was discussing righteousness, self-control, and the judgment to come, Felix became frightened and said, go away for the present, and I will find time. When I find time, I will summon you. So remember who this guy Felix is? A couple things. He's a master of cruelty and lust who exercised the powers of a king with the spirit of a slave. And he's got a wife that he's unlawfully married to. And what's Paul preaching? The opposite of anything this guy has ever been. But notice this. It wasn't the credence of the message, it was the content. That's why he rejected it. It wasn't because it wasn't believable. The message was believable. It wasn't the content, it wasn't the credence, it was the content of it. A man, a theologian from the 1800s, said, "The Christian ideal has not been tried and found wanting. It has been found difficult and left untried." By the way, he said that in the 1800s. Isn't that essentially the same thing that happens today? Which means what? Nothing's changed. Again.
There's nothing new under the sun.
There's nothing new under the sun. Fear was the right response, wasn't it? Fear was the right response. When he heard that, it says that he became frightened. And he ought to. We all ought to. The gospel is the good news, which includes what? You better change or you're going to go to hell. The answer was not go away. The solution for fear is not go away. That's sticking your hand in the sand. Rather, the answer isn't say go away. What is the answer? Change, repent, obedient. Go ahead.
Repent, fear God, obey Him.
Right.
He's a loving and long-suffering, patient, gracious, goodness. Don't overlook Him.
Right.
Don't turn away from
Him. Yeah. Behold the
kindness
and severity. He's both. That's he's just. The answer to fear is obedience. Look in 1 John, and that should say chapter 4. Verse 15, whoever confesses that Jesus is the Son of God, God abides in him and he in God. We have come to know and have believed the love which God has for us. God is love, and the one who abides in love abides in God, and God abides in him. Stop there. What is love? How do you abide in love? Look in chapter 5, verse 1. Whoever believes that Jesus is the Christ is born of God. And whoever loves the Father loves the child born of him. By this we know that we love the children of God when we love God and observe his commandments. For this is the love of God, that we keep his commandments. And his commandments are not burdensome. So stop back. Go back to chapter 4, verse 15. Whoever confesses that Jesus is the Son of God, God abides in him and he in God. We have come to know and have believed the love God has for us. God is love. And the one who abides in the love abides in God, and God abides in him. We understand from chapter 5, the one who obeys his commandments is abiding in the love. Verse 17. By this, love is perfected with us, so that we may have confidence in the day of judgment, because as he is, so also are we in this world. There is no fear in love. Perfect love casts out fear, because fear involves punishment, and the one who fears is not perfected in the love. Do you see that? Perfect love, which we understand from chapter 5, is perfectly keeping his commandments, cast out fear. Now, at the same time, we don't perfectly keep his commandments, so we rely on his grace, but we try, and we try, and we try. The answer to fear is repent. It's not go away, it's tell me what I have to do, like the people in Acts chapter 2. Men and brethren, what shall we do? By the way, their obedience included what? Baptism, right? Repentance and baptism. Fear is the right response. A word about self-control. By the way, if you have a comment or question, please. He was talking about righteousness, self-control, and what? The judgment to come. There's the fear part, right? Self-control. Righteousness and self-control. What's righteousness?
Being right before God,
also doing what is right before God. It's used both ways.
Just talking about obedience.
Right, yeah. Right. Obedience, if you obey God, you'll be doing what's right. Self-control, that is the issue, folks. I mean, if self-control weren't included, we'd all be right there. We'd be walking into heaven. Realize this, that in the last days, difficult times will come. Men will be lovers of self, lovers of money, boastful, arrogant, revilers, disobedient to parents, ungrateful, unholy, unloving, irreconcilable, malicious gossips, without self-control. You see, self-control, or being without it, is identified with these kinds of people. If you have self-control, that's identified with righteousness. 1 Corinthians 9. Everyone who competes in the games exercises self-control. It's an analogy. They then do it to receive a perishable wreath, but we imperishable. Therefore, I run in such a way as not without aim. I box in such a way as not beating the air. I discipline my body. It's a metaphor. He might discipline his body, but his point he's trying to make is, look, I live a strict life so that I can get to heaven. Galatians 3, the fruit of the Spirit is self-control. Galatians 5. Proverbs 25, like a city that is broken into and without walls is a man who has no control over his spirit. James 3, the word control is not used here, but bridle is. We all stumble in many ways. If anyone does not stumble in what he says, he's a perfect man, able to bridle, to control his whole body as well. 2 Peter 1, applying all diligence in your faith, supply moral excellence, in your moral excellence, knowledge, in your knowledge, self-control, and in your self-control, perseverance, in your perseverance, godliness, godliness, brotherly kindness, and brotherly kindness, love. So the question is this, how do we develop self-control? If we need it, and we don't have it, how do we develop it? Because after all, we need it.
Work on it.
Discipline.
Work. Discipline. Prayer. Anything else? It's right up here, part of it. I mean, this isn't all of it.
Diligence.
Moral excellence. Knowledge. You've got to figure out what it is you're supposed to be controlling yourself in. In your self-control, perseverance. That means that you're putting yourself in these situations. You're living life. And sometimes you might put yourself in a situation. Now, with that in mind, avoid prolonged exposure to things where you know you have weak self-control. 1 Corinthians chapter 7. This is a specific application of this general principle that I've just read. Verse 2. Because of immoralities, each man is to have his own wife and his own, and each woman have her own husband. There are desires there. The husband must fulfill his duty to his wife, and likewise the wife to her husband. The wife does not have authority over her own body, the husband does. And likewise, also the body does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. Stop depriving one another, except by agreement, for a time, so that you may devote yourselves to prayer and come together again, so that Satan will not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. You see, yes, put yourself in that situation for a little time because of prayer, but only for a little time, because otherwise Satan's going to attack your lack of self-control. Avoid prolonged exposure. Avoid it. That's the idea here. At the same time, if you can, it may be prudent to remove yourself altogether from the position of being exposed. Verse 2, because of immoralities, each man is to have his wife and each woman is to have her own husband. Verse 9, if they do not have self-control, let them marry. Here's an application of this. Here's a specific application. Look, if you can't control yourself, get married. That's what he's saying. Sometimes people have moved to a whole new location for no other reason than to give themselves a whole new perspective because they're trying to get away from some sin that they can't conquer up there where they are. So you move, and people say, well, he ought to control himself. Well, absolutely, he ought to. But guess what? If moving helps, do it. Go. Run from wherever it is. Do whatever you have to save your soul, right? At the same time, find godly leaders. Do you remember Exodus 32? So they make this golden calf. And what is said of Aaron? When Moses saw that the people were out of control, for Aaron had let them get out of control. Did Aaron let them get out of control? No, it's their own responsibility. But did Aaron let them get out of control? Absolutely. He was in charge. So find yourself leaders, whether they have authority or not, who are going to help you maintain self-control. If they don't demand self-control because of the authority of the word, we can demand self-control. Find leaders who will, or teachers or preachers or whatever, moms, dads, friends who will say that to you. Maintain self-control. Comments or questions? So, back in the book of Acts, verse 26, he had said, go away for the present, and when I find time, I will summon you. At the same time, too, he was hoping that money would be given him by Paul. Therefore, he used to send for him quite often and converse with him. But after 2 years had passed, Felix was succeeded by Porcius Festus, and wishing to do the Jews a favor, Felix left him imprisoned. 2 years. Could you imagine that? Too long. How many days is that? 730 days. You think a school year is long. And he's in prison. Or imprisoned. Don't think of, well, it's probably like a lot like ours now. Right? 2 whole years. He's not in a dungeon, not yet. 2 years. What would you be thinking if you were Paul? Remember, Paul is, if you will, a superhero. If you were Paul and you were in prison in chains, what you might you be thinking? That? Well, he might have been thinking, couldn't I be doing something else? Lord, you did it for Peter. Let me walk right out. Couldn't I be doing something else? I don't know what the answer from the Lord would have been other than, trust me, Paul. Trust me.
I know that would be Paul's perspective because when Paul and Silas were in the prison, even if it was overnight or whatever, they were singing hymns and glad to be persecuted for the Lord. So I'm sure the whole time he was thinking, this is a good thing.
This is of God. Whatever it is, it's of God.
It's not always clear when he was writing all these letters, or this is one of those times, but there were times where he was in prison writing letters to congregations to help through things. So he was doing what he could in the spot that he was.
So, what about you right now? Are you in a situation where you're saying, hey, look, Lord, can I be doing something else? Two things about this. Number one, if it is from God, then be content. If it's not from God, then yes, you can be doing something else and get to it. After all, I mean, actually, how many of us even ask this question to begin with? We need to have this kind of attitude. Lord, can I be doing something? What can I be doing? Show me, Lord, and you'll find the work. John mentioned this is a time when, or this may be a time when he's writing some letters. He's about to be in prison for 2 years. Somewhere around here, a little bit later probably, he writes Philippians. In Philippians chapter 1, verse 12. Now, whether this is written now or later, I want you to know, brethren, that my circumstances, this will have been written a little later actually, have turned out for the greater progress of the gospel, so that my imprisonment in the cause of Christ has become well known throughout the whole Praetorian Guard and to everyone else. And that most of the brethren, now listen to this, so Paul's doing some preaching, Paul's doing some teaching because that's what he does, Paul's doing some writing because that's what he does, and that most of the brethren, trusting in the Lord because of my imprisonment, have far more courage to speak the word of God without fear. Do you see that? Paul's in prison, you know what other people are doing? Preaching the gospel. So, Paul, couldn't I be doing something else? You know what God was doing with him? Giving other people, saying, hey, look at Paul. You can do it too. That's how Paul was being used right then. You never know, just because you're not actively doing something for God, which you ought to be, God might be doing something passively, even at the same time with you. Here's some perspective to something else to understand at the same time. In verse 15, some, to be sure, are preaching Christ even from envy and strife, but some also from goodwill. The latter do it out of love, knowing that I'm appointed for the defense of the gospel. The former proclaim Christ out of selfish ambition rather than pure motives, thinking to cause me distress in my imprisonment. So here he is in prison, and guess what preachers are doing? They're running around and preaching, not because they really want to save the lost, although that might be a result, but because they want to say, ha-ha, na-na-na-na-na, Paul, guess what I can do? I can preach unfettered while you're in there in prison. Some people are awfully crazy. Paul's attitude, what then? Only in every way, whether in pretense or in truth, Christ is proclaimed, and in this I rejoice. So he makes the most out of the opportunity no matter what. Who has the last laugh, as it were? Other comments or questions here? We have an acquaintance, or at least I know this person, who was a businessman and got caught up, mistakenly, apparently, in a Ponzi scheme that was caught. And guess who went to prison? He did. And in the 3 or 4 years he's been there, do you know what he's been doing? Preaching the gospel. And last number I heard, over 200 people had heard the gospel, and some of them had been converted. Now, it was his own foolishness that got him there to begin with, but at least now he's making the most of the time, right? That's what Paul seems to be doing as well. So, after 2 years, Felix is preceded by Porcius Festus. Verse 25, Festus, having arrived in the province 3 days later, went from Jerusalem to Jerusalem from Caesarea. And the chief priests bring charges. Verse 6, after he had spent more than 8 or 10 days among them, he went down to Caesarea, and on the next day he took his seat at the tribunal and ordered Paul to be brought. After Paul arrived, the Jews who'd come down from Jerusalem stood around him, bringing many and serious charges against him, which they could not prove. What a waste of everybody's time. And who will have to answer for that? They will. You are inhibiting progress. You are wasting your resource. What's your resource? Influence. Instead of saying, don't believe this man, they could have been out there saying what? You need to go listen to Paul. What a waste. Well, verse 9, Festus, wishing to do the Jews a political favor, answered Paul and said, are you willing to go up to Jerusalem to stand trial before me on these charges? Paul said, I am standing before Caesar's tribunal, where I ought to be tried. I have done no wrong to the Jews, as you yourself very well know. If, then, I am a wrongdoer and have committed anything worthy of death, I do not refuse to die. But if none of those things is true, of which these men accuse me, no one can hand me over to them. I appeal to Caesar. Then Festus said, whew, thank you, because he was in a bind, didn't know what to do. So he says, good riddance. Go to Caesar. After he conferred with his council, he answered and said, you have appealed to Caesar. To Caesar you shall go. Paul was pro-death penalty. Did you know that? What is the death penalty? What is capital punishment?
Just killing somebody if they were deserving of
death. Right. If they commit a crime deserving of death, then you kill them. Paul was pro-death penalty. If I am a wrongdoer and have committed anything worthy of death, I do not refuse to die. Who else in the Bible, I can think of one other main character, that was pro-death penalty, that is? Note the tense of the verb.
Jesus,
God. Right? Genesis 9, the law of Moses, it's all over the law of Moses, which is what he's talking about right here, and Romans 13. So, there are some today who say that the law, the capital punishment, the death penalty is, you fill in the blank.
Unconstitutional,
archaic, cruel, barbaric. Right, mercy, all life is of equal value. Bill Gates. All life is until you've committed a crime that is worthy of this. If we say no death penalty, that is being so presumptuous. God says, kill this person. And we say, no. Can you imagine that?
What did we just do?
Right. God, you don't know what you're talking about. I am smarter and more morally correct than you are. Can you imagine that? The arrogance of it. So, in John 8, there's the woman. Verse 1, verse 2, early in the morning, he came again to the temple. Verse 3, the scribes and the Pharisees brought a woman caught in adultery. And having set her in the center of the court, they said to him, "Teacher, this woman has been caught in adultery, in the very act. Now in the law, Moses commanded us to stone such a woman. What then do you say?" And you know the end of the story. He says to her, "Go away." He does not say to them, "Kill her." And so you see, Jesus himself didn't approve of the death penalty. Answer that. Because that's an argument. That's one of the main ones. John.
Two things. Where was the man? He was supposed to be right there at the same time. Mm-hmm. So they were going against their entire law to begin with. And they were just... And he also knew their hearts on what they were trying to do.
Right.
Trying to test them.
Right, they were trying to test him. The technicality is they're both caught in the act. They're caught in the very act. What does that mean? What happened to the man? What, did he run away? The point is that they weren't after justice, and technically they're supposed to bring them both and stone them both. Well, both of them aren't there, so it's a mistrial, throw it out. And in this case, it's a reasonable mistrial, and that's what Jesus apparently is appealing to. But Jesus himself commands in Romans chapter 13 the death penalty. Go ahead.
Was he also at that point not to be the judge? He was there for a different entire reason altogether. He was there to die for that lake.
Right. So. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Well, he's also standing there looking for her accusers, but they walked away after he challenged
them. Right. Okay. So, verse 13, after several days elapsed, King Agrippa and Bernice arrived at Caesarea. Okay, so we've got Festus and Felix and King Agrippa, and we've got the other council. Anybody follow what's going on here with all these people? Good for you, because it took me a long time. Understand this. All right, here's Rome. This is the Roman Empire. These are provinces. Okay, all these little areas. Now, quickly, if a province was at peace, it was controlled by the Senate and proconsuls, which ruled for 1 year, would control these provinces. If it was not at peace, it was controlled by the emperor, and he would send procurators, and they answered directly to him. They would rule for indefinitely, however long he wanted. Syria is an area where a man named Quadratus is answering directly to a guy named, who's ruling now? Does anybody remember? No? In our text right now, who would be ruling? Nero. So, but he's not crazy yet. Actually, about now he's getting crazy. Okay, but he's been ruling for some 6 years now. Okay, so Quadratus is ruling up here. He answers directly to Nero. Syria is in a bit of a mess, mostly because it's connected right to Israel, Palestine, or Judea. So Judea, the province of Judea, is in chaos. It has been for years. It's been in chaos. Now, this man, so this word governor is used of the proconsul. It's just used of a ruler. It's not a technical, like in New York State we have a governor and we know exactly who that is and what that position is. Here it's used of just like an authority. There's an authority. Well, what authority? We have mayors, so a governor is used the same way. Right now, this man is answering directly to him and he answers back to Rome, just so you know. Okay. At the same time, here comes who we see here, Herod Agrippa. Herod Agrippa is ruler of this territory right here, a little bit in here, and a tiny bit down in there also. But he comes down to greet, what does it say? They come down to pay their respects. Remember, Festus just shows up on the scene. Okay, so he hasn't been there for very long. Here comes Herod Agrippa. Now, these people are essentially peers. Not really, but essentially they're peers. One doesn't answer to the other. They both answer to the dude up there first, and then to Nero directly also, or indirectly to Nero. Just so you know, they have gone from Jerusalem through Antipatris, which we read about last week, and right now they're all at Caesarea. That's where they are right now, because this is where the ruler of the Judean province lives, in Caesarea. That's where all the hub of activity is. Here's something interesting. We have now read about all four Herods. Okay? We've got Herod the Great. He was alive when Jesus was born. Tried to kill Jesus. Jesus goes to Egypt. Herod dies, and his son becomes king. Jesus comes back. Condemns Jesus later. Herod the First is the one who kills James and tries to kill Peter. That's chapter 12. He dies in chapter 12. And now Herod Agrippa the Second is king. But he's the great-grandson. No, he's the grandson of Herod the Great. Okay, with that lovely mess in the way. Do you see? He's hanging around with this woman named Bernice. Bernice is his sister. And the kind of relationship they had was talked about all throughout the kingdom, especially back in Rome. So he has a relationship with his sister. Now, did you notice? Felix arrived with Drusilla, his wife, who was a Jewess. Drusilla. Felix was essentially Agrippa's brother-in-law. They were ruling. Oh, what just happened? I have no idea. Oh, dear. Wow. Watch this. Okay. So, Felix was down here. Oops. Felix was down in this area ruling, and Herod's up there, and they're actually brothers-in-laws there. So, I have no main point from that other than to keep us, hopefully, in our minds where everything is and what's going on.
The apple didn't fall far off the tree here, because Herod, Herodias or whatever, had Herodias, his brother Philip's wife,
right.
John Baptist, before he gets him,
right.
He ended up
with
John Baptist's death.
Right.
I mean, so look where it went.
Yeah, and Paul is about to say, look, you know all the customs. And he's about to be convinced, as we were saying earlier. Look, he's about to be convinced. But you know what? He's breaking the law as it is. He's with his sister. Even if she's a half-sister, you're not supposed to do that. That's Leviticus 19, Leviticus 22, or 21. So he doesn't care for the law. He doesn't really want to know it. We'll break there. Oh, I didn't realize the time is gone. Comments or questions here? We'll pick up next week in chapter 25. Thanks for your work.